Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. We're so glad you could attend. Come inside, come inside. There behind the glass stands a real blade of grass. Be careful as you pass, move along.
Well, do we have a special presentation for you this evening? Myself, Sean Palmer, Seth Kamens, the Bata Owls. It's the triumphant, the Three Musketeers, whatever you wish to call us, the Three Idiots. We're all here, and we're here to discuss the Hall of Fame. Seth Kamens, the Bata Owls. Seth, how you doing?
I'm good. Jake and I are ready to roll as I watch my beloved Terps losing at Penn State right now.
And Syracuse will start at 8 o'clock. And Nabate, who is in the greatest of moods this evening, how are you, sir?
Yes, indeed. I'm all right, you know, all right. Ready to get it rocking and popping. All right?
Great. So just so everybody's aware, this is going to be the format of tonight's show. So we have 8 Hall of Famers. It's a yes or no contest. We're going to try and convince you one way or another whether these 8 players should be in the Hall of Fame. All retired, all eligible for the Hall of Fame as of today. We have baseball first. We'll go to football, basketball, and then hockey to end because we all love hockey. Well, at least I do. But most of us like hockey. So,
yeah,
to start it off, we're going to take 3 minutes per person. So one person will go first, then the second person will go after. Obviously, that's the way it works. Then we'll have a little bit of a discussion. And then we'll move on, and we'll see how we can go through this. So with your first 3 minutes, we have Nabata Owls with the positive for Jeff Kent. Why should Jeff Kent be in the Hall of Fame? Mr. Owls.
All right, here we go. So Jeff Kent, yes, indeed. Good player, and a player that developed. He was a late bloomer because with the New York Mets, he was a decent player from the standpoint of he still put up decent, good power numbers for a second baseman where he averaged 17 home runs and about 70 RBIs from 1993 and 95, and that's when the Mets were rebuilding. So then he goes on to Cleveland, and still his career around 28, you would say that he was above the average second baseman because he had pop in his bat. But when he went to the San Francisco Giants and was able to put up monstrous numbers from 1998 to 2005, check out the averages he had in those years. It is comparable to any second baseman in the history of the game. 253 total home runs, averaged 28 home runs per season, 994 RBIs. That's almost 1,000 RBIs in 8 seasons as a second baseman, and 110 RBIs the average, batted .296. He was a major reason and won the MVP award as well in 2000, a major reason for the San Francisco Giants being perennial contenders. And, of course, unfortunately, they had a very tough loss in the 2002 World Series where they led 5-0 in the bottom of the 8th inning, and the Anaheim Angels came back. But Kent, pretty much when you compare him offensively to all of the second basemen in the history of baseball, he's up there in the leaders. 1,518 RBIs, 377 home runs, .290 batting average. That is Hall of Fame numbers for a second baseman. And I think, definitely the top second baseman in the game during that time period, a period of 8 to 9 years. So you got to put Jeff Kent in the Hall of Fame. He's not first ballot, but he has to go in for sure. And he's someone that, okay, didn't have the greatest attitude, had some issues from the standpoint of getting along with teammates, did not get along with Barry Bonds, but he was still a tremendous, effective baseball player. And I got to put him in the Hall.
All right, great. So the counterpoint from Mr. Kamens: why should Jeff Kent not be in the Hall of Fame?
Well, first of all, I think Nabate's argument is pretty valid in a lot of ways. But when I think about Jeff Kent, I don't really think about – I look at him in a couple ways. Number one, yes, he had 5 or 6 phenomenal years with San Francisco, and his home run numbers for a second baseman are very good, as is his RBIs. But I think about, I almost think, you know, in a lot of ways, this is a guy who played for six teams in 17 years. And he was pretty much booed out of a lot of these teams. Devontae stated that he was not particularly well-liked. I think that's an understatement. I think also, when you look at some of his stats, this is an extraordinarily hitter-friendly era. And I'm not accusing him of being in that, in the steroid, because he's never been accused. Nothing ever even touched on that. It was a very hitter-friendly era. As good an offense, he was a very solid offensive player. I don't know if I would have put him above Craig Biggio as the best second baseman of his era. I don't know if I would have put Roberto Alomar was a little bit before him, but was still during that frame was I believe a step above both of them. When I in Sean, for instance, is a big sabermetrics guy. And I looked at the sabermetrics when I was kind of doing some research on this. First of all, his defense was terrible. He was a below defensive average defensive player at second base. And I realized that can be overshadowed or that can be overdone by his hitting. But his defensive wins above replacement was a negative 0.6, which is, I think, 58th out of 68th in the rankings during that era. His WAR, which is wins above replacement, is 146. There's a sabermetric called JAWS, which deals with the wins above replacement and for both a career and for average. The average for the 20 Hall of Famers at second base was you had a WAR of 70. Your best 7 years were 45, and the other JAWS was 57. His were 55, 36, and 45. His numbers, a lot of them, he was also, remember, he was hitting, as you said, his best years were with San Francisco. I don't think there's any question about that. It must be nice to have have the best home run hitter of all time hitting right behind you. Makes things a little bit easier. You know, the argument we're going to have with a lot of these players isn't are they good or are they even very good. That's if they were not good or very good, they wouldn't be in this discussion. When I think of Hall of Fame, and this is an argument that Sean and I have had over the years on this show, I think of the Hall of Great. I have never thought of Jeff Kent as a Hall of Fame-esque player. Very good, yes. But considering he's never, I don't believe he's broken 20% in voting at this point. I just don't see him as a Hall of Famer. I see him as a very solid player who probably will never get there.
Well, I think Seth, I think you both bring up very valid points. Look, Jeff Kent was probably the best hitting second baseman of his generation. I think he was a better
best power hitting though. Best power hitting second baseman of a generation. Would you put him above Biggio as a hitter?
No, but he's still bad. Near 300 in his prime.
Okay,
years.
So here's the thing. Biggio was a compiler. Biggio was one of my favorite players of all time. No doubt. Biggio got into the Hall of Fame because Biggio won a gold glove as a catcher, as a second baseman, as a center fielder, and had 3,000 hits, the magical number of 3,000 hits. I think Kent was a better hitter than Craig Biggio, a better hitter. Does it overcome what he did on the field? No, he was a below-average third baseman, a below-average second baseman. Just a terrible teammate. But if you want to go seven teams, then you have an elimination of Reggie Jackson, you have an elimination of Terrell Owens, you have an elimination of a lot of Hall of Famers. So I'm not sure the seven teams really does anything for me. Nabate, go ahead.
And also, one thing about Kent batted behind Bonds. Bonds batted third, Kent batted fourth. He was the cleanup hitter for that team as well. So whenever Bonds got on base, Kent made sure to get him in. You know, like you can always depend on Kent to be hitting behind him. So Kent didn't bat in front of Bonds. He batted behind him in those lineups, those San Francisco Giant lineups. And just in general, like, you know, you look at, like, there are not many second. Also, there have been atrocious defensive players that are in the Hall of Fame. There have been DHs that, like David Ortiz, that's going to go into the Hall of Fame. You know, not comparing them both, but at least Kent played on the field. And you have someone as recent as Daniel Murphy, who is who has been a prolific hitter over the past two seasons now, because he, to me, was the MVP in the National League this past season, to me. But, you know, that's the thing. Like, you still have fielders in the Hall of Fame that weren't, you know, people that weren't great fielders in general. You know, Mike Piazza wasn't the greatest fielder who just got inducted. So, you know, you have to look at what made him effective during his time with, you know, during his time and during when he was prolific. 110 RBIs, averaging 110 RBIs in a 9-year stretch is unbelievable for a second baseman. It really is.
But Seth,
and
final
he also
point, we'll move on.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking actually at kind of the stats that are similar for players. Forgetting the second base aspect, but even from a hitting standpoint, Dave Parker, Miguel Tejada, Scott Rowland, Jim Rice, Luis Gonzalez, these are the people who's coming up as similar in that level. Very good players, although Rice a Hall of Famer, and that's debatable as well. But a very good player. But, yes, he was fourth and Bonds was third. But having Bonds anywhere in that lineup next to you, in front of or behind, is certainly going to impact the pitching. And
also too, remember, without Barry Bonds in his late 30s with the LA Dodgers, late 30s into 40 years old, he still was able to average over 20 home runs and average around 80 RBIs and bat around 290 in his late 30s without Barry Bonds.
All right,
a very good
so
player.
We have to move on
okay.
here. We have to move on from here. I do like the fact that Seth is utilizing baseballreference.com. We can certainly tell from his statistics going on here. The boss has some excellent points. And since these two are at it again, I'm going to go with Seth first. Tell me why Mike Mussina is not a Hall of Famer.
To me, it's a little bit more of a difficult argument than the Kent. Mussina, I'm going to use a word that you actually used with Craig Biggio. Mussina, in a lot of ways, was a compiler. He was a very good pitcher for a very long period of time. Jim Cott-esque, Tommy John-esque. He won 20 games one time in his last season, in the last game he ever pitched, in the last game of the season, I believe. He was a solid 17-win guy for a very long time. He never won a Cy Young. His total wins was decent, nothing special. His career ERA of 3.7 was, I think, 3.68. Would be the third highest ERA for any Hall of Famer behind Red Ruffing and I forget the other guy, but he's even older than I am. I think he's from the 1890s. Mussina was a very, very good pitcher. But again, I go back to the point I always seem to make with these. Was he the best of his era? I don't think so. Was he among the best? He's in the ballpark. I have less of an argument with him making it than with Ken. And I think he eventually gets in. But to me, he's a Hall of very, very good. A borderline Hall of Famer, which I would go either way on and not really give a second thought to.
It's interesting because the pitching, certainly you said he has no special numbers. His wins are not special. However, I think in the concept of pitching these days, you may not get to those special wins anymore. You may not get to the 300 number, and 250 may be the new 300. And that's something that we have to take a look at with John Smoltz getting in, Curt Schilling looking to get in. There will be a lot of pitchers coming up in the next couple of years that will not have that magic 300, and a lot of precedent is going to go on. Now, Nabate, tell me why Mike Mussina should be in the Hall of Fame.
All right. Well, I have to say the Moose was from 1992 when he started. He was an all-star. Had a 2.54 ERA, 18 wins, 5 losses. So from 1992 all the way basically to 2004, 2005 when he was with the Yankees, signed a big free agent deal. He's been one of the best pitchers in baseball in his era. He finished in the Cy Young voting, in the top five of the Cy Young voting. He finished six times, finished in the top six eight times. He won five gold gloves. So that shows that he was one of the best fielding pitchers of his era as well. So he wasn't one-dimensional just being a good pitcher. Also, another thing with Mussina, the durability, major durability, and this is like the last time we saw pitchers, pretty much we see pitchers compiling innings. Mussina from 1995 to 2003, nine straight years, he had over 200 innings pitched by far in each of those seasons. Pitched over 220 innings in six of those years. So you look at in five of those years, excuse me, and also pitched 241 innings in 92. So the durability, the fact that he was a top five pitcher in the American League for over a 10-year period, was, and also remember the Baltimore Orioles, the last time they were really contenders, he was their ace. Then in, after 1997, they didn't make the playoffs until 2012. Then they made the playoffs 15 years later. He went to the Yankees in 2001. He was the rocket at rotation. And remember too, Burt Blyleven and him have very similar numbers. Burt Blyleven, similar WHIP, similar ERA. Similar innings and wins totals as well. And Burt Blyleven made the Hall of Fame easily. So how come Mike Mussina, who when relief pitching in the 90s started to take more precedent, he still put in major innings and had a rubber arm for years. So he should get in. Like, he was pretty much an Iron Man. He was a throwback. He's really, he should have been pitching in the 60s and 70s. So basically Mussina is a Hall of Famer, great fielder, as well as a good pitcher, and also in the postseason, he was very effective in the postseason. He struck out more than one strikeout per inning, as well as had a 3.42 ERA, 7-8 record, but still was solid in the postseason, had dominant outings. So Mussina, that longevity, as well as his versatility as a player, gets him in the Hall of Fame. And like I said, you compare him to Burt Blyleven, it's their numbers are even.
Well,
Blyleven
no.
certainly did. We all know Burt Blyleven's one of my guys, and he has been my guy for much like Tim Raines.
And yeah,
he's your
Burt
pitching
Blyleven.
Version of Tim Raines. But Burt Blyleven didn't get in
easily.
He got in on his 14th attempt.
But Blyleven has some things over Mussina, and I'm not saying Mussina's in or out, but Blyleven certainly has some things over Mussina. Number one, he wasn't easily in. He got in on his last year. So the easy
and that was – yeah, that's my mistake. That's my mistake in the debate. Thank you for the correction on that. Absolutely.
So that's number one. Number two, Burt Blyleven had 59 shutouts in his career. I don't know how many Mussina has. I didn't do the research of this, but nobody has 59 shutouts anymore, and those are complete game shutouts. But –
Mussina had 23.
You hit the Burt Blyleven button, and I was kind of like, eh. But
Blyleven had 1,000 more.
The reason why I compared,
Mussina ever the best pitcher on the Yankees?
Yes. There were a couple of years that he was. Yes.
I would concede that. He never won a championship, unfortunately, with the Yankees. He was there for 01
yet,
when they lost.
You know what's messed up about that? 2000, they won a championship. That was his last year with Baltimore. Then
in 2009, they won the championship.
2009 was his first season away from the Yankees when he retired, and they won the title. Oh, man.
Yeah.
So he had Don Mattingly syndrome.
Yeah. It's actually
exactly.
Very similar. The issue with Blyleven also, Blyleven, number one, Blyleven openly pretty much was solicited votes for the Hall of Fame, if you remember, more than anyone I've ever seen. He had 1,000 more strikeouts, and he also played on a lousy team for the most part of his career. Yes, they won championships in 87 and 90 or 91, but they were terrible for the crux of his career. And I mean, this is as borderline to me as he gets. He led the league. He led the league in wins once. His ERA was not special. His strikeouts were not special. His fielding was special. He was probably one of the two or three best fielding pitchers of our generation. I can see the argument either way. I think eventually he probably does get in, but I wouldn't give as a Yankee fan, I thought he was a class act as well, so I would like to see him get in, but I'm not pushing one way or the other. And I think in a down year, he will. I just don't think it's happened
yet.
Or it certainly hasn't happened
yet. Just so you know,
can I
my
response?
Yes, about that.
Yeah, go ahead, Nevada.
Yeah. In my response, and that's what I was saying about Blylevin, he pitched in a pitcher's era where pitchers were throwing 250 to 320 innings per season. Frank Tanana, Nolan Ryan, Steve Carlton, those guys. Like, so that's the thing. Like, so of course he would be able to get wins, but he also had a lot of losses with those terrible Twin teams. But that's what I mean with the difference. Mussina was still, his winning percentage was much better as well. He had a 63.8 winning percentage as well. So that's the thing. Like, that's what I'm saying. He was able to have a rubber arm, and he was a throwback compared in the 90s. Relief pitching set more of a precedent, and he was able to get decisions, leave the game, and be able to get decisions without having to pitch nine innings like Blylevin did. So that's what I'm saying. And remember, you cannot take away the five gold gloves. I think we talked about defense with Jeff Kent earlier. You said that was a detriment to Jeff Kent being a Hall of Famer. Then the gold gloves should really enhance Mike Mussina being a versatile player.
You will absolutely
get
no argument from me. Just so you know, two things, and then we'll move on. One, Blylevin won three championships because he won one with Pittsburgh. So that's important to note. Number two, who's the man that has the most gold gloves for any pitcher in history?
Jim Cott, I think.
Jim Cott, who has 268 wins. So it's just an interesting side to what we're looking at with Mussina. About the same wins, different era. Looking at the gold gloves, I don't think Cock got more than 5% any one year. Okay, we need to move on for football, which supposedly
I'll take over two
of the guys. So,
I will
Seth,
take over for now. Okay, so the two, I will be debating the second Hall of Famer. The first one, one of the great linemen, defensive linemen of his era, overshadowed a little bit because of where he played and who he was. Nabat saying, why should L.C. Greenwood be in the Hall of Fame?
L.C. Greenwood was a very versatile player. He was one of the great run-stopping defensive ends in the history of the game. He was part of that steel curtain, just like Joe Green. You know, like, he was as significant as Joe Green was in his day. When they four-time Super Bowl champions, when they anchored that defensive line. But L.C. Greenwood, he was someone that had, like I said, could stop the run, could rush the passer, and he did a lot for that defensive team. Remember, you have Mel Blunt, that is a Hall of Famer. You have Jack Lambert, it's a Hall of Famer. Jack Lambert, I think, was an overrated middle linebacker because he had that great defensive front in front of him. Jack Ham was able to do a lot, you know, and be able to be effective with those guys in front of him. So L.C. Greenwood was someone that was very, very effective. He was dominant at times. And if you put Blunt in the Hall of Fame and Lambert in the Hall of Fame, Joe Green in the Hall of Fame, Jack Ham, I believe, is in the Hall, I believe, you have to put L.C. Greenwood as well. Especially, you know, and like I said, pass rushing, he was able to do a lot from the standpoint of pass rushing. He had the size. He had everything going for him for that Steelers team. So I would say L.C. Greenwood definitely should be in the Hall, and probably he'll go in as a veteran, the veteran committee. But you have a lot of veteran guys that are in that are like, okay, you know, whatever, you know. But six-time Pro Bowler, also two-time first-team All-Pro with a talented defense. Also 1970s all-time, all-decade team as well. Remember that, 1970s all-decade team, he was in that. And the defensive players on that were Carl Eller, Carl Eller, Jack Youngblood, six-time finalist. Joe Green is on that too.
Bob Lilly is there too. So you have that there. LC Grunewald should be in.
Okay. Sean?
And he was second. He was second. Second team, actually.
Okay.
And six-time finalist. So. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Sean, why should LC Greenwood not be in the Hall of Fame?
Okay. So I don't necessarily have deep roots in this. When we did all this strategy, it was a 1 through 5, and I come squarely on a 3. And the reasoning that I have this is very simple. You cannot induct a whole team. It just doesn't work. This isn't like the 1980 Olympics team that got inducted or a tag team in the WWE Hall of Fame. You cannot induct every dealer from that team. And when we were talking about Jeff Kent before, Seth minimized Jeff Kent because he played on a team with Barry Bonds. Navate, I get your point about Lambert. I get your point about him. But some of that also has to apply to LC Greenwood to me. You have Mean Joe Green in the middle that's taken up 4 guys. So, of course, you're going to be able to get around the corner a little bit better when you have a guy in the middle that's taken up all those men. Donnie Schell's not in the Hall of Fame for that very reason. Donnie Schell should be in the Hall of Fame, too. But you know what? You can't induct a whole team. I don't necessarily dispute the fact that LC Greenwood will get into the Hall of Fame. In fact, I believe he will. My point is that while dominant a defense it was, not every player did it on its own, his merit. So the fact that you can't induct everybody, and the reason he hasn't been inducted so far, I truly believe, is because the Hall of Fame Veterans Committee has the same concept that I do. There are just too many of them in there. So that's the reason he hasn't gotten in. It's going to take some time. I think Greenwood eventually does get in. Like I said before, I had him as a 3. It's not a 1. It's not a 5. It's a 3. So let's go with that. I concede this, and I'm going to concede the next Hall of Famer, too, because I had him as a 3 also. I don't understand why I'm doing football, but it's okay. So you know what, Navate?
Well,
you win. Game on. Induct him tomorrow. We're good.
The reason you were probably not included in the Mike Mussina argument was because you would have brought up Burt Blyleven, and that was just not tenable for this discussion.
Darn it! Anyway.
Navate, you do bring up a lot of good points. His stats are fantastic, and you both bring up good points because I agree the issue, and to me, Donnie Schell would have been probably in before LC Greenwood, although I think they both get in eventually. But Navate, I want to ask your opinion on it. We're talking, you said Lambert. Overrated or not, he's in. Andy Russell, in. Jack Ham, in. Green, in. Blunt, in. At what point, when you look at the great defenses of all time, you look at the 85 Bears, Singletary was an absolute stud, in. Hampton, in. But you don't see 8 people from that defense in there. The Ravens of 2000, Ed Reed's going to be in. Ray Lewis is going to be in.
Oh, Ed Reed wasn't on that team.
Oh, that's right.
Ed Reed wasn't
after,
on the
my
team.
Fault.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
No, you have
after,
Woodson
my fault.
In. You have
Woodson's
Woodson
the one
in.
That I'm missing.
You're going to have Suggs in. You're going to have Lewis in. So you got
no
three
Suggs
on
wasn't
that
on
team.
That team either.
Suggs wasn't on that team, and I don't even know Suggs
yeah,
is a Hall of Famer either.
Sorry, that was Thomas.
Right, Navate, but the argument is, for these all-time great defenses, now admittedly they were not as great for as long a period as the Steelers were. But at what point do you have to say enough?
But also, like I said, he was a first team All-Pro for 2 seasons in a row, 74-75, and also the sacks, he was one of the first, he was one of the great pass rushers of his era.
That was the thing. Like, and could stop the run. That was another thing about him. So it wasn't that Joe Green was taking up – I don't think Joe Green was taking up all those blockers in the middle. Still, you know, still LC Green was a left defensive end that had to – excuse me, a right defensive end that had to deal with left tackles, you know. So that dominant left tackles at the time, and he got to the quarterback at will. And remember, he had 4 sacks against Roger Staubach in Super Bowl X. That's a hell of a performance right there. He could have been named the most valuable player for Super Bowl X. So, excuse me. So I think Greenwood should – he has to be added from what he contributed and his dominance related to other defensive ends.
I don't dispute any of what you just said. Not one bit. But I know that we have to move on to Chuck Howley. So, Nabate, will you please do the honors for Chuck Howley?
All right. Well, Chuck
Wait, I thought Chuck Howley was
yes.
Me.
So, because we have I'm the moderator for this one, but we Yes. Chuck Howley, very interesting player, Super Bowl MVP, Super Bowl V, champions, and the only player to win MVP on a losing team as well. 6-time Pro Bowler, 5-time first-team All-Pro, part of the Dallas Cowboys Ring of Honor, one of the great players of the 60s and 70s. So let's go with first. We'll have Seth give his reasoning why Chuck Howley should be in the Hall of Fame.
Well, I think you kind of named half of it right after reasons right there. You know, you kind of look through. He was Super Bowl MVP in 5 when they lost to the Colts in probably the worst Super Bowl of all time. He actually almost won. He could very well have won it when they went back the next year with a fumble recovery and an interception when they beat the Dolphins. Tom Landry has been a coach for how long? He was an assistant for the Giants for several years before he became the head coach for the Cowboys in 60. And then he left when Jimmy Johnson
89.
Took over in 80,
right.
88, 89.
88 was last year.
Okay. So he was involved with football for 37 years and said he was the best coach, best linebacker he's ever seen. That alone should be enough. 6-time Pro Bowler, 5-time first-team All-Pro, you know, as you said, Dallas Cowboy Ring of Honor, players you can never imagine. Unfortunately, I mean, he played for about 12 years before he actually got hit, unfortunately, by a crackback block. And that was the end of his career. I actually find it unbelievable he isn't in the Hall of Fame. When you think of the great linebackers of the 60s, Tommy Nobis, Joe Schmidt, Sam Huff is a little bit before that. But usually Chuck Howley's name is right. Willie Lanier, Chuck Howley's name is right there, and that he isn't in, I really think is a shame. And this is someone who does not like giving credit to Cowboys, but I think this one's kind of a no-brainer.
All right, and now Sean, your reasoning for why Chuck Howley should not be in the Hall of Fame.
I don't got one. We're back to the same point where I had it as a 3. No, the fact is, you know what, Chuck Howley's not in the Hall of Fame. There's really no reason other than the fact that he's out of sight and out of mind. And the NFL has tried to do this in a different way over the next couple of years. I think they have this as a 10-year thing, where there are 2 contributors 1 year and 1 senior or a legend committee member each year, and it goes back and forth. So next year there'll be 2 senior members and 1 contributor, and that's kind of why Paul Tagliabue probably won't see the light of day for a couple of years, if not over a decade, as far as I'm concerned. But the fact of the matter is, he probably will get in, but the problem is he's so out of sight and out of mind. He hasn't played in 40 years, so people don't remember him. And he doesn't have those sexy stats because it was before the sack. It was before they really counted tackles. So there are no – the issue with older players is that those sexy stats just didn't exist. So it's very hard to enumerate what a Jerry Kramer did. it's very hard to enumerate what a Chuck Howley did. In some ways, it's hard to enumerate what an Elsie Greenwood did, but it's not really hard to enumerate what Richard Dent did, because Richard Dent had a sack number. So if Tom Landry says he's the best linebacker he's ever seen, who am I to dispute what Tom Landry says? I mean, Tom Landry is the king of Dallas football. I do dispute the fact, because he's in a ring of honor, that all of a sudden he's a Hall of Famer, because, yeah. I don't know. We have a Secretary of Education right now because she paid her way in. I'm sure somebody could pay their way into the ring of honor. But anyway.
That's a whole other show right there.
Hey, that's
a
whole other podcast.
A whole other show, anyway. But
there'll be a lot more drinking during that one.
Yeah, you know, Nabate and Steph, you guys are right. There's really no reason for him not to be in. The reason he's not in is pretty much the same or very similar to Greenwood, is out of sight and out of mind. I'm okay putting him in. Look, put him in. Great. That ends this segment of our broadcast. Let's move on to something else I'm not a part of, and that's the NBA. So let's move on to the NBA. Where suddenly my fives and my ones. Oh no, I'm a part of this. Awesome, Nabate, take it away with Rudy T.
All right, so we have Rudy Tomjanovich was involved with one franchise his entire career. Well, until he coached the LA Lakers, but was associated with the Houston Rockets as a player and a coach. So we will go with Seth first on why Rudy Tomjanovich should not be a Hall of Famer. Am I right, Seth? I think you have him not going to the Hall, right?
Yeah,
no,
I don't have him in
the
Hall.
Going to the Hall. Oh, you don't have him in the Hall. Yes. So,
no,
Seth,
I don't have him.
Take it away.
Take it away, my friend. Rudy T was a very nice player and a very nice coach. And there's a bit of an asterisk on both. Rudy T, went to Michigan, as his number retired. Of course, we're talking professional basketball. We're talking basketball Hall of Fame. We have to include college as well. But he's a five-time All-Star. But his stats really, unfortunately, when he got punched by Kermit Washington in 1977, after 5 or 6 years, he never came back the same player. And he had his career average of 17 points. He averaged about 17 and 8. So did Buck Williams. He's a very nice player. He's a very popular player. But he wasn't someone who I would consider I would even think of in the Hall of Fame. And then you go to the coaching. He was a good coach. He won 2 championships in an era that will always be the non-Jordan era. There's no other way to look at it. Jordan retires in 93 for 2 seasons. Houston beats a pretty mediocre for a finalist. For a finals team, Knicks, and an extraordinarily green Orlando Magic. He won who was there. They beat who was. I can just see where this is going. He beat who was there. He was a very good coach. And then after that, it really kind of dissipated. He, the last 4 years he was in Houston, they didn't make the playoffs. He did coach an Olympic team, but I mean it's really hard to lose in the Olympics at that point. Very good. I wouldn't put him great in either way, on either as a coach or as a player. Very good, and I'm a Hall of Great guy.
Okay, Seth. I see your points, and I compare him to Joe Torre. Because Joe Torre was not a great player. And he was a very good manager on great teams. And he had great players. And I don't see I don't see many people losing with the Yankees. The same way as you are saying you need to coach the team that you have at the time that you have. Well, Nabate, not to say anything different, but you could have put Terry Collins in a Yankee uniform and he probably would have won a championship with that team, and he can't manage a bullpen to save his life. So the fact is, Rudy Tomjanovich has the career record for rebounds at Michigan. He was the number two pick overall, made five All-Star teams. You're right. He has that asterisk. He got punched by Kermit Washington, which may be the best punch I've ever seen. It landed square on the jaw and the face. Well,
you gotta watch the Mikey Garcia fight from 2 weeks ago. But
all right, sorry. Anyway, All-Star five times, didn't win the championship ring, but then top 10 finishes, minutes played, 3. Top 10 free throws, top 10 points, top 10 points per game. He did that once each in 73 and 74. Joe Torre is very similar in the fact that his career as a player didn't get him into the Hall of Fame. His career as a manager got him in, and it was a combination of the both. And I think that's where Rudy T gets over the hump. And look, you just made a case that Chuck Howley was going to be a Hall of Famer because Tom Landry said he should be a Hall of Famer. Well, Kobe Bryant wanted to be managed by two people, and Kobe Bryant, one of the best players of all time, wanted to be managed, coached by three people in his career. One of them happened to be Rudy T. So he kind of thinks that he's kind of good. So, even though it didn't work out. Rudy T in the Hall of Fame. I think when you combine the body of work, yes, that is the first time we have said that on this program, the body of work, you have a Hall of Famer. And I think I put him as a 4.
And I have to add, before we have both your closing remarks on Rudy Tomjanovich, I have to add with Tomjanovich, he overall, like from the standpoint, he's in the top 25 in winning percentage of coaches in NBA history. And you look at someone that also, too, remember, this Houston Rockets team did not get over the hump until Tomjanovich took over as their coach. They were perennial contenders, but they didn't get over the hump. And that New York Knicks team in 1994 was a very good New York Knicks team because they were the second best team best team in the East. I mean, and then of course when Jordan retired, they took over as the number one team in the East. But just one thing. And another thing about Tomjanovich is that a six-seeded Houston Rockets team in 1995, no six-seed has ever won the NBA championship. And they had a great run, and that was through Rudy T, and they defended their title. And any coaches that have won two championships, they're all in the Hall of Fame.
Well, I remember the run well. I remember Mario Elie hit a huge three-pointer in Game 7 against Phoenix. I don't remember if it was the conference semis or the conference finals. But I remember the run that they had. That was when they brought in Drexler halfway through the year.
The semis against Phoenix. Okay. Semis. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm doing it off the top of my head.
And they came back from a 3 and that's a 3-1. Came back from a 1-3 deficit, and they were the road team in Game 7. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes, they were. But, you know, Sean, you compared him to Torrey, and I understand that. But Torrey won four championships in 5 years. Went to another one the year after. Tomjanovich went to two championships, both without Jordan there. You know, they didn't lose to Chicago at any point. They didn't make the finals any time before or after that. The Knicks team was a good team. It was not a great team. They were a good team. Orlando was a very, very, very young team. Even if they had made another final or something and lost to Chicago, I can see the argument a little bit better. I have trouble seeing it going to two championships. I just do. Good coach. Good coach.
So,
he's not a Hall of Famer in my mind.
You said a very good Knicks team. That just means that they weren't just a very good team. They just happened to be a good team for the Knicks. I was just curious which one that was.
Oh, man. Hey, my Knicks team is 8-42.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is coming from a Knicks fan, I guess. But the fact is, you know what, Seth? I don't dispute
what you just said. I'm doing a lot of that this evening, is not disputing. And if you saw my Tom Brady article, I'm totally in the non-dispute with Seth these days. But the fact is, I don't dispute it. I just have, where do you draw the line? He doesn't have to be Phil Jackson to make the Hall of Fame. He doesn't have to be the best coach ever. He just has to be in comparison to other coaches. And as Nabate eloquently put, when you win two championships, history says you're in the Hall of Fame. That's it.
Tom
Coughlin
anyway, going to the Hall of Fame?
What's that?
Well, that's a different sport. Different sport.
Different sport. I was saying history in the NBA. History in the NBA.
But I made, I want to say two things before we move on. Two quick things.
Sure.
That my mistake. Casey Jones is the only one not in the Hall of Fame. He's as a coach. He's not, but I believe he's in as a player. So, and then also too, that top five. I don't know the order. I forgot the order. But Bob Lanier, Rudy Tomjanovich, Pete Maravich, Sam Lacy, and oh my God, who's the other player? I forgot the fifth player. I'm going by my memory, but they were all like top five picks in that 1970 draft. What a great draft! So.
Yep. So anyway, so we had Nabate and Seth arguing one malcontent happily in baseball, and now we move over to the other malcontent, which happens to be in Detroit. And that would be in basketball. Hey, you got to give me props on the term malcontent right here. I mean, it's a big word for me these days. Mark Aguirre out of DePaul, went to the Mavericks, then to the Pistons, and then Isaiah, he was traded for Adrian Dantley, and they won a couple of championships with the Bad Boys. So, Nabate, tell me why Mark Aguirre should be in the Hall of Fame.
That's a major difference. He made the major difference on the defensive end, Mark Aguirre, because Adrian Dantley didn't play defense. And I can confirm that in working with Rick Mahorn a lot. Rick Mahorn was on that first championship team, and he was also on the team that Adrian Dantley was on the year before. But that was the major difference. Mark Aguirre adjusted his game and was always a good defender, became a great defender with the Detroit Pistons. Now, with the Dallas Mavericks, he put up numbers. I mean, the first 8 years of his career with Dallas, he averaged, with the Dallas Mavericks, he averaged 24.6 points a game with the Mavericks. I mean, he was an elite scorer, and you can make comparable to Mitch Richmond pretty much. Mitch Richmond was on losing teams. Mitch Richmond overrated? Is it?
You just poked Seth. So continue on.
We'll get to that in a second. Okay. No problem. But Aguirre put up major scoring numbers, and that Dallas team, they were one win away from making the NBA Finals in 1988, and they were perennial contenders in the Western Conference. Now, he wins two championships with Detroit. Also, too, you look at his college numbers as well. He was the number one pick overall out of DePaul. And he was a major, major scorer for the number one team in the country in DePaul, averaged 24.5 points a game, had over 2,000 points in three seasons with DePaul, because remember, we're including college as well as the NBA ranks, and also he's a three-time All-Star in a very deep Western Conference with a lot of forwards at that time. So overall, Mark Aguirre, one of the great scorers, became a great defender with the Detroit Pistons, and he was that missing piece for them winning the NBA title. He was able to make key stops throughout those times, and also, of course, like against Portland, he gave Clyde Drexler a lot of troubles. It was between Joe Dumars and him guarding Clyde Drexler, and he was an undersized forward as well. He was undersized too, from the standpoint of only 6'6", really, but he played like he was. He played like he was a bigger player from the standpoint of he would guard power forwards. He was a big, physical guy. So Aguirre, overall, he's a Hall of Famer when you include the college and pro ranks.
Before we move on to Seth,
I'd just like to point out you just poked Seth's two favorite players of all time, referencing Clyde Drexler and Mitch Richmond in the same
sentence. Exactly.
So this should be
well
all
done
sorts
of
interesting.
Seth's mind.
All you had to
all
do is pull up Dr.
interesting the rebuttal. Seth, I give you Mitch Richmond and Clyde Drexler. Please tell me why Mark Aguirre should be a Hall of Famer.
All you had to do to Bob Fay was include Dr. J, and you completed the triumvirate. Nice job. Mark Aguirre was not a Hall of Famer. Mark Aguirre was a very good player. He was a great college player. He was a very good scorer on Dallas. It was a Jerry Stackhouse deal. Not the same kind of player, but a lot of scoring and not a heck of a lot else. Had three or four rebounds, averaged, I think, four or five rebounds over his career, averaged three assists. He comes to Detroit. Now, you remember, in 88, they went to a brilliant seven-game conference semis against the Lakers with Roy Tarpley, and that was the year Tarpley was not on drugs, and James Donaldson and Rolando Blackman and Derek Harper. They go to the seven-game series. They lose to the Lakers. If he was that valuable to that team, why are you trading him? He was disliked in Dallas. Both sides, he wanted out. They wanted him out. He got Dick Motta fired. He goes to Detroit, and yes, his defensive game was up massively in Detroit because it was the bad boys. The reason they traded Dantley is because Dantley refused to play defense. Aguirre going to play with his childhood friend Isaiah Thomas knew exactly what the play was. He became a solid defender. But how good a defender do you have to be when you have Dennis Rodman, John Sally, Bill Laimbeer, Rick Mahorn, Joe Dumars, and Isaiah Thomas? You have the defense. Everyone's there. He was a good player. He was a very good player. He averaged 20 a game for his career in the last 4 or 5 years in Midland, Detroit, because he was concentrating more on Dean. He wasn't playing as many minutes, but he was playing for a winning team. Very good player. But honestly, never even contemplated him as a Hall of Fame player until this. Very, very good. Not great. If you want to throw the college in, you want to throw the Olympic that he was on, maybe the Olympic team, I can see a borderline argument. But never even crossed my mind of him as a Hall of Famer. I'll be perfectly honest. Before our rating, I think I had him as a two. I just never thought about it.
Okay.
No.
So a couple of points just in the middle, and then we'll get back to the Bate. Number one, we all knew that Adrian Dantley didn't play defense. We watched the games. You didn't need Rick Mahorn to confirm that. We all saw it. We all knew why he was traded to begin with.
Well, of course, but I had to make that reference because he played with the guy. And probably,
no,
understood.
Understood. Trying to create a little levity to the situation here. Number two, you do have to include the college game. And to your point, Aguirre was a dominant college player. So,
and the number one pick overall, you know, so.
Well, so was Kwame Brown, and he's not going to the Hall of Fame either. The one thing
but
that
come
does,
on, he justified
that,
me.
That now, did, no, wait a second. The one thing that you did give him a little bit more credit for that I would not have is being the final piece to the puzzle. Because there have been several final pieces to the puzzle that are nowhere near Hall of Famers, and Butch Goring being one for the New York Islanders. You can go to many different teams. Just because you're the final piece of the puzzle doesn't necessarily make you a Hall of Famer. It does make you the final piece to the puzzle. Okay, Nabate, please, your counter.
Now, okay, you look at the Hall of Famers. You have Walt Bellamy, who had around the same scoring average. You look at Dave Bing. Dave Bing and Mark Aguirre could have comparable careers, actually, when you think about it, when you look at the scoring numbers. And also the fact that Aguirre, his friend, he played on a winning team. You have Dan Issel as well, who's a great ABA player as well. So that's included in his Hall of Fame numbers. So you look at Mark Aguirre overall, and it's like, yes, you know, he his numbers are comparable. The college career is very important. 3 years, having 2,000 points, over 2,000 points in 3 years, that's amazing. People usually get to – players usually get – elite college players usually get over 2,000 points in 4 years. He did it in 3 years. Also, like I said, the DePaul Blue Demons were the top team in the country at the time. They didn't make a Final Four, unfortunately, but overall – in the regular season, because you know the NCAA tournament is flukish. Overall, they were the top team in the country, and they've never sniffed it since he left. That's the thing. You have to look at that program. But as I mentioned before, two-time champion. He was the third scoring option. He still averaged, in 36 minutes, still averaged near 20 points a game. His numbers went down when he went to Detroit because they were a very balanced team from that standpoint. But he provided scoring when he needed to provide that scoring. And overall, you know, you have to look at that, his overall career from college, and that's what I look at. I think NBA individually, he wouldn't make the Hall of Fame. But when you look at overall his numbers from college, then you have to see, you know, you have to give him that edge for him to make the Hall. So
all right. So Seth, now that Nabate has poked Clyde Drexler, Mitch Richmond, and the Syracuse grad Dave Bing, go right ahead, and please,
I got
you. This
I got your back on cue. Okay, first
Thank
of all,
you.
Walt Bellamy averaged 22 points and 13 rebounds a game. Mark McGuire is nowhere near that. Dan Issel averaged 22 points and 10 rebounds a game. Mark McGuire is nowhere near that.
I'm
Dave
talking
Bing
about the NBA.
The...
In the NBA.
Yeah.
NBA.
Okay.
NBA.
Okay. Dave, well, you can only judge Walt Bellamy and Dan Issel by where they played. You can't judge Dan Issel strictly on playing for Denver in the NBA because he played his prime years in the ABA. Dave Bing was a member of the All-NBA. I don't think you can argue. I don't remember seeing Mark McGuire's name anywhere near there.
But Walt Bellamy averaged 20 point. So he averaged the same as Mark McGuire, Walt Bellamy.
And had 10 and had 8 more rebounds a game. You know, Jeff Malone averaged 19 points a game. That's within a point of Mark McGuire, too. Jeff Malone was certainly not a Hall of Famer.
Was he the number one option on? Okay, sorry. I'll let you see. Okay.
He was number. He was Jeff. He was number one option in Washington. That's not saying a hell of a lot. I mean, Mark McGuire was a very good player. Whether he was a Hall of Famer or not, he just. I mean, to me, when I look at that era, it was an era of a lot of forwards scoring a lot of points. Adrian Dantley, Alex English, Kiki Vandeweghe, all these guys scored 23, 24, 25, 26 points a game in their prime. Yes, Aguirre may have been the best of that group. May not have been. I honestly don't remember. But there was none.
Hall
there
of
was
Famer?
Nothing
except for Kiki.
You think Kiki? Well, first, Vandeweghe is certainly not a Hall. Vandeweghe should not be a Hall of Famer.
No, no. I said.
I said
except for Kiki.
And
but
I probably
all
okay.
Hall
and
of
I probably
that you named.
And I probably wouldn't have had any of those in there too. I'll be honest. They were. It was an era of high scoring. I mean, you said it before. It was a forward based era. And if Aguirre only made, what was it, 3 All-Star teams, what they're really saying is, you know, especially in years where he was averaging 25, 26 points a game, that these guys that I just mentioned who made more of those All-Star games, apparently they were seen perceived as better.
Or they
and
remember
they
Aguirre saw, wasn't liked.
Aguirre wasn't liked.
Coaches
fair.
Voted.
Coaches voted, media voted. Aguirre was not liked. Aguirre supposedly pushed out Mata in Dallas. And I have a problem with a guy who was supposedly the best player in a team that took a team to the borderline of a finals and they gets traded half a year later. It rubs me the wrong way. I don't know because to
guys,
me there must
got,
have been –
we
okay.
We got to move on to a little bit of hockey, which I happen to have both guys. So I'll let Nabate, you're leading. Go for it.
All right. So Claude Lemieux, I'm telling you, he's one of my favorite players growing up. This cat was – if he was on your team, you would win the championships. That's for sure. I mean, just – I love the way he played and the way his – you know, that hit on
Draper.
Yeah, that was very rough. Chris Draper. Yeah, that was very rough, and that was very sad to see. But other than that, very interesting player. So now, Sean, you are first to let us know why Claude Lemieux should be in the Hall of Fame.
Claude Lemieux should be in the Hall of Fame for the same reason that Dino Cicerelli is in the Hall of Fame, because he won, and he won a lot. And please do not bring up the fact that Frank Grossetti has like 20 World Series rings, and he's not in the Hall of Fame, because I know that's going to come up soon. Claude
Lemieux,
Big Shot Bob. 379 goals, tied with Ted Lindsay. Just like Ted Lindsay, he has 4 Stanley Cups. Lindsay's in the Hall of Fame. Shockingly, Lemieux topped 30 goals 5 times in his career, had a best of 41. You're saying, yeah, he never had 400. Okay, I concede that. Did you know he scored 80 in the playoffs? Those are kind of important. He led the postseason when Montreal, the Canadiens, won the Stanley Cup. Yeah, you forgot he was on that team, didn't you? 94-95, he had 13 goals. 4 game winners on his way to the Conn Smythe and a Stanley Cup in New Jersey. Following season, he would go to Colorado and win the Stanley Cup. And here we are again with Seth going to bring up the point that why was he traded if he was such a great player? Well, in hockey, I think it's a little bit different than most sports. Hockey, you get those ringers. Hockey at the deadline, one guy can make a difference. And they are traded a lot more than they are in any other sport. For God's sake, Wayne Gretzky was on 5 teams, and he's the best player in NHL history. Bobby Orr was on 2 teams. Yeah, you forgot he was on Chicago at the end of the year, at the end of his career.
Gordie Howe.
For all those reasons. What's that?
Gordie Howe.
Gordie Howe with the Hartford Whalers.
Hartford Whalers.
All of these players. Lemieux was the 4th player to win a Stanley Cup with 3 different teams. 3 different teams. And even more so, he played on the World Cup team for Team Canada. And still, they finished 2nd. The next year, he was again in the Stanley Cup playoffs. Shockingly, if you wanted to win, this was your guy. He played when he was 43 years old. I can't skate, and I'm 40. So, I mean, there has to be something to that. So the fact of the matter is Claude Lemieux deserves to be in the Hall of Fame for the very same reason that Dino Cicerelli does. And I get that Dino had 600 goals. But Claude has 4 cups. Dino don't got no 4 cups.
All right. So now, coming up on Seth on why Claude Lemieux should not be in the Hall of Fame. Go.
Dino Cicerelli, as you said, had 1,200 career points. Claude Lemieux is nowhere near that. And I really don't have an issue with Claude Lemieux playing for 3 different teams. Again, I agree with you. Hockey is a very different sport. However, there is one thing that does kind of come into play a lot. And we joke about it on our show that we don't take it seriously because we don't. How could a guy be in the Hall of Fame who never made an All-Star game? How is that even possible? And yeah, Claude Lemieux never made an All-Star game. Not one. Clutch player? Yeah, he had some great playoffs. The playoff series, the Devils nut playoff series in 95. He was fantastic. Should he have won the Conn Smythe? Probably Marty Brodeur should have won it. Or Scott Stevens should have won it. But you can argue either way. I don't have an issue with that. He was an instigator. He was a pain in the ass. According to Cam Neely, he was a gutless puke. He was the guy you loved having on your team. He was the guy you hated playing against. But that doesn't make him a Hall of Famer. That makes him a pain in the bleeping ass. And that's the guy he's the glue guy. He's the guy you love to have. I get why the Devils wanted him. I get why Colorado traded for him. I get why Detroit had him. Montreal had him. I understand that. But his stats were mediocre. He never went to an All-Star game. Never. He thought of more in retrospect in disgust than anything else. Yes, he played a long time. Hockey players tend to do that. But he's not a Hall of Famer. He's not even I wouldn't have even thought of him again. You know, when I went to a list, it was interesting. I went to a website, not in the Hall of Fame. And it ranked the top 100 players in each sport, not in the Hall of Fame. Claude Lemieux didn't make that list. He was about in the honorable mention below that. He was not a Hall of Famer. He was an instigator. He was a clutch scorer. He was a tough guy. He was a guy I wanted on my second line in a game seven anywhere. But that doesn't make him a Hall of Famer. A Hall of Famer. Ooh. A Hall of Famer. That just makes him clutch.
Okay. With a politically incorrect comment.
Now that we're blaming all over
that's
the
another,
place.
That's another podcast.
Exactly.
Okay.
But before we go to Sean to give his closing argument, Lemieux, to me, yeah, he's like a glorified Big Shot Bob. Glorified Robert, he's the Robert Ory of hockey, pretty much, you know. Except he produced more from the standpoint of scoring. So, and I mean, like I said, I love Lemieux, but he's someone that I mean, when you look at his overall numbers and not making an All-Star team, that really kind of takes him out of the mix for being in the Hall, you know. But that's just me. But anyway, so Sean, you're next with your closing argument.
There are definitely hockey players that have not made the All-Star game that are in the Hall of Fame. I can tell you that flat out. 100% there are hockey players that have not made the Hall of Fame. Hockey All-Star game, talk about a glorified exhibition.
Well, can you name that? Name some of those players?
You want me to go find out? By the end of this broadcast, I will have that name for you. But the fact is, there are. And you don't put a Claude Lemieux in the All-Star game for obvious purposes because he's going to chop somebody's head off. the same way as I would like – I'm going to go find out how many All-Star games Dino Cicerelli made. Because I don't think there were that many either, maybe one or two. Clark Gillies made one. I know that for certain. One All-Star game. He's in Hall of Fame. Just because you're an All-Star doesn't mean – an All-Star's a glorious – like you said, a glorified exhibition game. I get what you're saying. I do. However, 80 goals in the playoffs. 80 goals! John Smoltz. That's his whole resume. That's Curt Schilling's whole postseason resume right there. And granted, I just picked one that was and one that wasn't. But you're going to get to that point where you're going to say, look what he did in the postseason. Look, Mariano Rivera made his name in the postseason. He did. I'm not saying he wasn't a great regular season pitcher, but he is going to shoo in the Hall of Fame, while Trevor Hoffman, who has very similar regular season stats, will not. So my point is the playoffs count, and they count a lot. And this is not Big Shot Rob, who had one bucket to win the game. This is – he led the playoffs in scoring. This is Hakeem Olajuwon in the playoffs. This is Hakeem Olajuwon in the playoffs. This is not Big Shot Rob. I'm done.
Okay. And Seth, your final take on why Clark
–
How
many years did he lead the playoffs in scoring?
Twice.
Did he lead one?
When they won cups.
So he won four cups. So he led twice in goals.
Yeah, he led twice in goals.
Okay, so probably the Devils in 90. I'm assuming the Devils in 95 and probably one of the Colorado years. So based on two great playoffs, and he had a couple other good ones, that makes him a Hall of Famer? That doesn't make him a Hall of Famer.
80 goals in the playoffs, Seth.
He played
goals
for 50 years.
He didn't make the playoffs all of 15 years.
He played for 20 years, 19 years. He played in a lot of games. He played with three very good teams. He played with Montreal when they went to a cup. They didn't win one, but they went. He played with the Devils in 94 and 90. They won one, but they didn't.
They won a cup.
They won. Yep. You know, a lot of this was he played. He was never. Nobody ever said, man, I'm concentrating heavily on Lemieux. It didn't. Maybe the 95 Devils team they did because they didn't have a great singular offensive threat. But when you look at that Colorado team, who are they really looking at? They're looking at Forsberg and they're looking at Sakic. Call it what it is.
Yep.
You know, when you look at that Montreal team, you're looking at Brian Bellows. You're not looking at Claude Lemieux. And you're looking, you know, again, he was a solid, he's a pain in the ass. He's a guy you love to have. He was a clutch player, but he was not a Hall of Famer.
Okay.
All right. That was the best debate. Definitely.
Thank
that
you.
Was really good, guys. Yes.
Thank you. Well, that just means that you guys are pretty much have to surpass it. And this one is going to be pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Beloved in New York, pretty much well-liked, as far as I could tell, everywhere. Mike Richter, the goalie of the 94 Rangers, to me, will always be the goalie for the U.S. team in 96 in the World Cup in the World Cup of hockey, where he put on one of the greatest exhibitions of hockey goaltending I've ever seen. Played about 12 years with the Rangers, never played anywhere else. You know, this one should be fun. Dabate, and also for the record, let's remember, there is not a team alive Sean hates more than the New York Rangers. So we'll take that for what it is. Dabate, why is Mike Richter a Hall of Famer?
Oh, no, I said he's not a Hall of Famer.
No, the other way around, my friend.
Ooh, this is weird. Okay. Mr. Islander fan, why is Mike Richter a Hall of Famer?
Which just goes to show you how much I think Mike Richter is a Hall of Famer in the fact that Mr. Islander fan, and there is no team that I hate more than the New York Rangers, thinks that Mike Richter is a Hall of Famer. Mike Richter is a Hall of Famer. He won 42 games with the Rangers in 93-94, leading them to a Stanley Cup. He won the 1987 World Championship in four games in the U.S. in the Calgary Winter Olympics. Remember, again, that this is not the NHL Hall of Fame. This is the Hockey Hall of Fame, okay? So it's very important to notice that as a junior, Mike Richter played for the U.S. and won a gold medal. He won the Vezina, was a finalist for the Vezina Trophy. He had a couple of bad seasons, I understand. Was an all-star to Seth's point, needs to be an all-star. Of course, to make the Hall of Fame, you need to be an all-star. We've talked about that numerous times. And 1998, the Nagano team. Are you kidding me? This guy is an absolute Hall of Famer for the reasons he stopped the streak with the Rangers, where I didn't think that would ever happen, and unfortunately it did. They haven't won since, to Nabate's point, that all of a sudden Hall of Famers have to be like the star stud and then they lose after he leaves. So they haven't won a Stanley Cup since he left, not that they won one before he was there. So he was the missing piece, too. So I can put all the buzzwords that gets Mike Richter into the Hall of Fame. Mike Richter is a borderline Hall of Famer. I will tell you that flat out. He is not a perfect Hall of Famer. He has a record of 301 and 258 with a goals against of 2.89 in the NHL. And I'm sure that's what Mr. Isles is going to bring to the table in about 30 seconds. But if you take his body of work, both the juniors, the college game, the World Cups, the Olympics, and the fact that he was an NHL goalie with 300 wins, this man is a Hall of Famer.
All right, and let me tell you, Richter, and there's not a team I love more than the New York Rangers. So it's interesting,
really?
But
I'm
a Ranger fan.
Okay.
Yeah,
anyway.
Yeah, of course. So anyway, Seth, you knew that. Anyway, on the real though, I think Mike Richter over a long period of time. Was not the dominant goalie. He had that great season with the Rangers in 93-94. But I'm talking about was he a top five goalie in his era in the 1990s? He wasn't in the NHL. And that's the thing. And goaltenders, it's very, you know, goaltenders that are in the Hall of Fame, you know, you have to be dominant throughout your time there, you know? So I look at goaltenders, for example, in that era, I look at Patrick Waugh, was not a Patrick Waugh, was not a Marty Brodeur, even though he did beat Brodeur in that close series in 1994, which was a classic epic series of the Rangers passing, moving on to the Stanley Cup. But he wasn't a top-notch goaltender of his time. And the thing is that with Richter, the amateur career, great. The Olympic career, great. And that's the thing. Like, I think he's very good, but not the Hall of very great, you know? So, and Richter, I think, you know, like, he may get into the Hall, and I wouldn't be upset about that. But I just think that that overall he didn't have that dominance in the NHL for a long period of time, and that's what gets him close, like short of making the Hall, just short.
And I think they both are pretty reasonable takes. I mean, what I look at was what you brought up, Nabate. You look at it was a goaltending era, and you know the way I've always looked, and I know it's ad nauseum to Sean at this point, is you know I look at the best of an era. Mike Richter was not the best of an era. He was not better than Dominic Hasek. He was not better than Patrick Waugh. He was not better than Martin Brodeur. He was a tier below that. Maybe, you know, you want to put him in the Curtis Joseph area? Fine. So to me, I find it's a difficult argument simply because he wasn't one of the best of his era. But at his best, he was as good as any of them. It was just, to me, too short of a period of time, as you said. I mean, Sean, the argument you seem to be making is 300 wins, his performance in the Olympics in the 96 World Cup, which you actually didn't even bring up, which was the best I've ever saw him play. I mean, is that that's enough to get him there?
Yeah, that's enough. Like I said, I think he's a borderline Hall of Famer. He's not a Dominic Hasek first ballot. Well, first ballot is irrelevant. But Dominic Hasek Hall of Famer, where he's a slam dunk guy. But I think internationally, he makes it. And I think you're going to have a similar argument with Curtis Joseph when it comes time for him, which will be next year, I believe, in the NHL Hall of Fame. So you're going to have a similar argument as to whether he should make the Hall of Fame. Now, Curtis Joseph does have a lot more wins. I believe he has a lower goals against, but certainly something that we have to do. So let's bring this back around. Sure.
Okay.
Go ahead, Demonte.
Oh, one more thing, too. With the Vezina Trophy, he only finished in the top five only twice in his career. Like, you
yep.
know, so that's another thing, too. Like if he was and the Vezina back, basically it was the top three, really, that would get recognized, and that was only once, and that was his rookie season. But I think it was a travesty that he didn't get more consideration for that one season. He was only sixth in the Vezina, which I don't even know what in the world were they thinking. It's just weird, you know?
It was a goalie era, as Seth said. You know, we talked about this last week, and we have about 12 minutes to go, so I think we should touch upon this. We have a Hall of Fame discussion going on right now, and we just had the NFL declaring their Hall of Fame. And Jake is obviously playing piano of some sort. Seth is trying to do something.
Oh, Jake's playing? Oh, okay. Jake's playing right now? I got it. Now we have to have
Jake.
We have to have
you may want to mute me for about 30 seconds.
Okay,
and
no
we
problem.
Have muted Jake. Anyway, so we'll get
so we have
we'll
to
get
have Jake transcribe Herbie
okay.
Hancock solos, you know?
There
he
you go.
Transcribe
so,
some Herbie
so
Hancock
the fact
solos.
Is, Nabato, we have Terrell Davis making it after 4 years. Four real years. What do you look, Seth and I discussed this last week. I was totally not on board with the Terrell Davis election, and he got elected. Seth, we both got it right. We both got seven guys. We just got the wrong seven guys.
Well,
yeah.
I'm not too proud of myself for getting Morton Anderson in when Terrell Owens didn't.
Morton Anderson's the best kicker ever.
Yeah, but at the end of the day,
Vinatieri,
he's still a kicker.
Before Vinatieri.
Oh, he's in the argument. Terrell Owens is a Hall of Famer. I'm shocked. I mean, as disliked as he was by a lot of people, he was one of the two or three best of his era. Like him, dislike him, he was impossible to guard, and to guard one-on-one. He was big. He was strong. He'd go over the middle. He may have been a pain in the ass, but he was, there is
but
no question in my mind. He was my pain in the ass. Well, he's never my pain in the ass. But
here's the thing.
You know,
Navate, I'd like your views on this. Next year, we have Randy Moss.
That's
Randy Moss did a whole lot of the same things that Terrell Owens did. Do you think he's going to get docked nearly as much?
That's a great question. I think really when you think about it, Randy Moss actually had worse off the field issues. You know, marijuana, was kicked, you know, kicked off of the Marshall team, I believe. You know, like he was kicked off that team.
No, he kicked off of Notre Dame. Went to Marshall.
Notre Dame. I'm sorry. Yes, it went to Marshall. Yes, and Florida State as well. He got well, but that's before the NFL.
Hold on, guys.
Let's remember, for football,
it actually is the Pro Football Hall of Fame.
Well, that's what I'm gonna get to.
No,
but that's what I'm gonna get to. He still had controversial moments with the Minnesota Vikings, a la. But Terrell Owens, though, you know, Terrell Owens never got in trouble with the law. Terrell Owens, a lot of people said that he was a great teammate. And also Terrell Owens, in the one Super Bowl that he was in, Terrell Owens had 150 receiving yards while Randy Moss somewhat disappeared in his game against the Giants when he played and when the Patriots were playing for a perfect record. So, and Terrell Owens also was more physical than Randy Moss. Terrell Owens blocked. You know, he was stronger. Randy Moss did not like to go down the middle. T.O. did. So I'm just saying they're even from that standpoint, and it's a shame. I think Randy Moss should get the same flack that Chris Carter got, that Terrell Owens is getting. Randy Moss should still get the same flack, you know. And one more thing before we move on, well, before we stay in the conversation, before you guys have something to say, Jason Taylor, how is he in the Hall of Fame? He was not one of the top 10 defensive ends in the history of this game because of his sack numbers? What? Like, you know,
well,
class act and everything. Come on now.
Navate, I'll give you the reason. It's very similar to what I was saying before. You have a sexy number. You have a sack number. You have a defensive player of the year. I believe it was in 2011, maybe 2001. I believe it was one of those two, maybe 2001.
Mm-hmm.
The fact is, you have a sack number. You have a sexy number. Neither Seth nor I picked Jason Taylor to go into the Hall of Fame last week. Neither one of us. And I was shocked that he was in there. Seth, what do you think? Were you shocked?
I wasn't shocked because he's well-liked. I don't believe he belongs there. But I wasn't shocked. I was shocked. To go to your Owens-Moss argument, the thing about Moss is, as bad as he was, Moss has rebuilt his image. Moss was pretty good in New England, meaning there was no issues. And he got a lot of publicity and a lot of play there while that happened. He's in ESPN right now, where he's rebuilt his image and is a pretty good announcer. I actually think that's why he gets in next time over Owens. Think he was a better all-around player than Owens? No. But Owens has been unable to shed this negative aura around him and was hated by and as much was just immensely disliked by the media. And now that Randy Moss is part of the media, a lot of that disagreement, a lot of that rancor has dissipated, I think. I was not particularly impressed. I told Sean this. I thought this was one of the weak, going in, looking at this group, I thought this was one of the weakest classes I had ever seen. There was nothing out there. To me, the best player in that group was Terrell Owens. There was nobody, and Tomlinson probably was right there as well. Tomlinson obviously is a Hall of Famer. But there was no one there where I looked and said, that's a, you know, other than Tomlinson, and said, okay, that's a gimme. I was shocked neither safety made it. I was just not impressed.
Yeah, but one safety that made
I was even more shocked that neither one of the safeties made it, right? I mean, Dawkins and no Lynch. Yeah, I was, and that Jason Taylor made it was just something of an anomaly to me. I was kind of, what are they thinking? And unlike the other sports, with, especially baseball, which will now be incredibly transparent and they must release their votes, the NFL seems to not want to be doing that.
And it's interesting, too, with Jason Taylor. I'm looking at his numbers, his career. I'm like, it's kind of interesting. He was all-decade team in 2000. He won Defensive Player of the Year 2006. Three-time All-Pro, six-time Pro. I'm looking at his numbers. I'm like, interesting there. But one player, before we move on from the talk of the – because we got to talk about Super Bowl. One player, Kenny Easley. Much deserved. He was the second best defensive player in the 80s behind Lawrence Taylor. No question. And Ronnie Lott will even tell you that. You know? And he didn't have the talent. Kenny Easley didn't have the talent around him like Ronnie Lott did. You know? So props to him,
well,
the enforcer, being in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, Seth and I both had him in. We got 4 minutes left until we got to depart. So give me Nabate, give me one quick take on the Super Bowl and what you see for the Falcons going forward.
I think the Falcons are in very good shape going forward. They have, remember, the six of their core players, Deion Jones and Keanu Neal and Vic Beasley, those guys, they were all drafted within the last 2 years. So you look at them, and also you also look at, too, Desmond Trufant he didn't play. So he's coming back. So that's another thing. So that adds another element to their defense. I think the Falcons are going to be fine, but they just have to I think it was just bad coaching decisions. And they'll come back because they have a young core. They have a couple of years where they can be able to still have that same core and not have to worry about, you know, paying them and making sure they stay, you know. So I think they can win the Super Bowl in the next 2 or 3 years. They have
a good
core.
You got one
and
minute.
Matt Ryan is
give
getting
me
better as he.
I would you
Seth,
say? I got 1 minute.
Go.
Job in recent memory. How they don't run the ball three times with, you know, with an 8 minute with an 8-point lead with 3 minutes to go is unfathomable. You know, some of you saw on Facebook, Sean, and you can hear Jake's commentary on it in the background. Sean, you know, wrote a letter posted on Facebook for Back Sports Page saying, conceding to me that, you know, Brady is the greatest of all time after this. And, you know, I get no great satisfaction out of it. I'm not a Brady fan. But, I mean, the reality is it's subjective. It will always be subjective. I know Nabate considers Peyton Manning, I believe, considers Peyton Manning the greatest quarterback of all time. I believe. I could be wrong, but I think that's what we've discussed in the past.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know how to compare Otto Graham. You know, I don't know how to compare Johnny Unitas. But to me, one game doesn't cement Brady. But when you look at the surrounding his surrounding players to come back from 25 down, it's an incredible reflection of what this guy means to that team. And just, but it shouldn't be based on one game. Is what I'm saying, though. He's not the best of all time because of his comeback. He's either the best because you think he is, or because he's not. And that's what I think people have to kind of get off the dive on.
So 1 minute left. My letter was basically a cementing of it's not necessarily just because of this one game, but this one game puts it over the top for me, and that's the reason why I made it in the first place. So. If you'd like to check out the letter, it's on Seth and Sean Sports page on Facebook. Please check us out. Thank you so much to Nabate Isles for joining us tonight. We had a great
time. Pleasure, gentlemen. Thank
you
for having me. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Next week we'll go into the NCAA basketball because, you know what, we haven't talked very much about it, and the Maryland team is looking pretty good. So for Seth Kamens, Nabate Isles, and myself, Sean Palmer, thank you all very much for joining, and have yourselves a great week. We'll check you out next week. Bye-bye.
Peace, everybody.